The ANU Emeritus Faculty has for a number of years been conducting interviews with retired members of the university. The purpose of these interviews has been to gather and maintain a history of the university as far as possible from individual members who contributed to its community and development over decades of time. Today, Colin Steele will be discussing his association with the ANU. By way of introduction, Colin began his association with ANU in 1976 as the Deputy University Librarian. So, Colin, would you like to tell us a little bit briefly about your times before you came to the ANU?
Yeah, because I think some of that's very relevant in terms of my life as a librarian. And I came from a school, Hartlepool Grammar School in England, at which I went because of the 11 plus examination, which I think was the key to my subsequent career. And at Hartlepool Grammar School, I was the school librarian. And then when I went to university subsequently, I was the university hall librarian, and then ended up obviously as librarian of the ANU. But I think some of the early life trickled through into what my interests were and subsequently did at the ANU. So I might just mention those briefly. I think the 11 plus in England was a crucial issue in terms of a lot of working class, unquote, people getting to university. And in fact, in my life, two of those were from grammar schools, and one of them, Professor Bob Hart, who was at the same school as I was, is now just retiring as Professor of Economics at Stirling. And he's written an analysis of grammar schools in England and the impact both socially for those people and the people who didn't get in, which were the vast majority. So there are a lot of social issues there. And when I went to Liverpool University to study history in 1962, I ultimately ended up in a postgraduate flat with a man called Ian Kershaw, who is now Sir Ian Kershaw, the famous biographer of Hitler. One of the things I have in life are signed collections, and I still remember Ian signing the two-volume Hitler. But when I bought, before he signed it, the first volume of Hitler, the lady in the bookshop said, when I said, oh, I shared a flat with him, she thought I'd shared a flat with Hitler, so it was interesting in terms of bookshop history. So I went to Liverpool University to study history, graduated in 65. Then you had to do a practical year in a university library in order to go to the University College London Postgraduate Library and Information Studies. So I spent a year in the Harold Cohen Library at the University of Liverpool, which is very interesting. They weren't used to having people who were actually, I was about to say normal, but that's not the right word, to having people in the library, because it's usually a place where they put people who had a nervous breakdown. So there were several academics in the cataloguing department who had nervous breakdowns. Anyway, subsequently went on to University College London, which had major people lecturing from the British Museum Library, and I studied in particular Latin American history, because I was doing a postgraduate degree thesis in Latin American history. So I studied Latin American bibliography, which turned out to be very, very useful in terms of my first job, which was at the Bodleian Library in Oxford in 1967, because they were recruiting for the first ever time professional librarians under the then librarian Robert Shackleton, who came out to ANU several times to the HRC. So I was a part of an intake of five professional librarians in 1967, and I think we did revolutionise to some extent some of the procedures that were going on in a very historically and very important library. As part of the Latin American studies, I became associated with St Anthony's College, Oxford, and became an associate member and spent quite some time at the college as well as. So you were looking basically at what was a scholar librarian, which was then the ilk in the Bodleian. And the working week was 34 hours, so you, in fact, had quite a lot of time to do research, and you could actually then, as a member of staff, go off in the stacks and get the books for your research instead of having to put them in the old Bodleian. So there's quite a lot of history that I learned at the Bodleian, both socially and intellectually, because I was very pleased that I ended up at Oxford at the age of 22 rather than 18, which would have been really quite disastrous socially, as my cousin, who was the first of the family to go to Cambridge in the early 50s, suffered quite a lot socially in that context. So we benefited from a number of societies at Oxford and made quite a few contacts. And I also published three books there and edited two, because again, you were meant to be a scholar librarian. It was quite clear, though, by the and quite a lot of the time involved going to America and Latin America to buy books or to work on university library things. So they were very helpful in that sense.
So you did quite a bit of travelling at that
yeah.
time.
Yeah. So my first visit to America was in 1969, because there'd been a Shackleton committee looking into the university libraries. But one of the curators, a famous medieval historian called Trevor Aston, actually didn't go to the University of California, San Diego to do automated circulation and went off to Tijuana instead, but that's another story. So I went to 1969 to visit American libraries, and that was the first visit I did. But I also went a number of times to the University of Texas at Austin to work on Latin American collections and also for Latin American bibliography. That was one of the major collections in the world, or probably the top collection in the world, for contemporary Latin America. And we quite liked Austin. You know, it had heat, it was a small provincial capital. So that when we were looking for jobs, and they were quite keen for me to go in 1974, but we weren't quite sure about America. But in early 75, two jobs came up, one at the ANU and one at the University of Melbourne.
Because I was going to ask you, how did you come to the ANU?
And we were therefore looking, because my wife at that stage had given Anna, who we'd married in 1967, and she'd been a history teacher in Oxford in one of the high schools. And she, in that day, gave up teaching. So we had one salary coming in, which wasn't huge. And basically, we were looking to the next level to go up to. And we thought, well, maybe we'll just go away for 3 years in looking at jobs. And so two jobs came up in Australia, and I applied for both. What was very interesting in the process was that the University of Melbourne, we then had interviews in London, which was fine. The University of Melbourne then wanted, in its normal way, to fly me out and have another interview in Melbourne. And then ANU decided they didn't want to fly me out because they either had I had walked into, without really knowing, what was known as the Milton Sims affair, who was the librarian prior to me and had been appointed in 1973. So I should just go back a bit then in ANU's history to say what then impacted us and what followed. So there'd been two librarians at ANU, ALG MacDonald, and I'm the only person still alive who knew all the librarians in terms of librarianship. So MacDonald was still alive. He had been the initial librarian at the foundation of the university. And I also remember him telling me the story that he was very impressed one Sunday night when he got a phone call at her home, and his wife said, "Oh, it's the Prime Minister, Robert Menzies." And MacDonald had actually gone through were we going to build a Chifley? Well, Chifley hadn't existed then, but what was the status of Menzies?
We're talking about the Menzies Library now, aren't we?
And so, because he'd originally started in the huts near Menzies. And the Prime Minister's on the phone, so he thought this was something to do with the Menzies building, which was 1963. And in fact, it was. The Prime Minister was asking about the cricket score in England, whether he'd heard the latest, because Colin MacDonald was the opening batsman and his son was the opening batsman for Australia, so he was somewhat disappointed. Anyway, he retired, I think, around about 1961. It's in the history of ANU Library. And Jack Granique took over, who came from Queen's Belfast. And he was in the tradition of scholar-librarian. And I still remember the Deputy Vice-Chancellor at the time saying, when I came, because this is one of the issues that happened, not that I would have had time for being a scholar, unquote, is that Jack Granique had had three overseas study trips of 6 months on the Dead Sea Scrolls, but had never produced any article or any book on this. So they were very keen in 1973 to change direction of the library. And Milton Sims had been the librarian of James Cook, then a very small university. And he was known as an expert on automation, having only, in fact, as we found out subsequently, automated 200 records in terms of circulation. So he was seen as this new charismatic early 40s or late 30s, early 40s librarian, complete contrast to the dignified Jack Grinning. So he was appointed but quickly ran foul, perhaps again of making change too fast, but also in terms of his work and what was going on. And in fact, so there was a quite considerable staff, academic and internal staff concern in the early 1976 when I was being interviewed in London. No, it would be 75. The reason I say that is when we were looking at ANU, so this would be 1975, my wife and I were in Kidlington and Oxford in our house, and they said, oh, Canberra's on the television. So we looked, and of course it was November 11, 75. And we looked, and there was Gough, and the shop was going back towards the Walmart.
Yes.
And we couldn't see a house. We were just looking for houses.
Yes,
we couldn't just see a house at all, wondering where the houses were. So obviously there was a decision taken that, because the referees' reports had been pretty good, that they would appoint me. So we had then the decision, what do we do coming to the ANU or Melbourne, because Melbourne was still open, and they were, you know, sort of... and then ANU said, oh, we'll up the number of increments... ANU said, we will up the number of increments we will give you. And at that stage, the Australian dollar was still relatively high vis-a-vis the pound. So we asked around Oxford about whether you had the choice to go to Melbourne or Canberra, what would it be? And it was something like 90% said go to Melbourne and 10% said go to Canberra. But two people that were very influential was Robert Shackleton, who basically had been to Australia and thought this was... The HRC had a lot to do with Ian Donaldson, who was then the director of the HRC. And Max Hartwell, who was a very famous economist who had left the University of New South Wales but was a Bodleian curator and was a fellow of Nuffield. And there were a number of others. However, when I went to... had a farewell from St. Anthony's College, the Japanese expert called Story, his wife met my wife and said, oh, you don't want to go to Canberra. We were there in 1951 and we had a wooden stove and there was lots of redbacks and whatever, which put Anna off somewhat. So anyway, with two children, three and one, we came out to Australia and arrived in August 1976, because it took a long time to go through the ANU bureaucracy, let alone the... I don't think there was any problem in getting a visa or anything. It was just the whole bureaucracy ran slowly, particularly in the sense that I was being kept away from Milton Sims to some extent, who was the librarian. So it was a very strange procedure in some respects. And we arrived on August the 15th, I think, or something, 1976, in Canberra, in an August day, which was cold, wet and windy. Then there was no, as you may recall, Fife, there was then no luggage thing. It was put on a trolley outside. So we arrived in the wet with the trolley coming down. And there was an accident on Commonwealth Bridge, so the business manager, Kim Christie, who informed us that we would have to drive through a place called Fishwick in the rain, and secondly, that he'd just resigned as number 17 of the resignations of Milton Sims, so it didn't make for a very grim arrival in Canberra. We were putting one of the flats in Marnica on the left-hand side, which are now super flats, but nobody sort of welcomed us, and it was cold and very little furniture, and the kids were three and one, and Christopher had been a bit traumatised leaving Oxford. So we wondered what the hell we'd done. And Milton was rather strange, to say the least, because he was spending every day working on building a property out at Lake George, and then would sleep in the library at night, leaving messages for the day staff, which is very strange, and the cleaners would find him. So we were still not quite sure what we'd done. So that was arriving at ANU. By December of that year, we bought a house in Hawker, which we're still in, and... that proved excellent and gave Anna some base to from which to work. Then the library, of course, didn't get much better, because in trying to stand up to Milton rationally, It wasn't easy because he wouldn't turn up for budget meetings and he wouldn't turn up for preparatory meetings. And at one stage, I had to get Bev Hawkins, who was then the EA or the secretary, to get Sims back from Lake George for a major budget meeting, which he didn't like. So he then basically, after about 6 months, said, as was his wont, perhaps I would like to become the head of social science humanities in Chifley, which wasn't the job I'd been appointed to. Basically, this sort of brought everything to a head. And in people, the chairs of the library committee had been Ralph Elliott, who'd been extremely good and one of the very welcoming people at ANU. But he wasn't really, perhaps the word is tough enough in retrospect, to take on, you know, what is really deposing a university librarian. But fortunately, we had Dennis Carr, who was then in RSBS. And I didn't realise until much later that he'd been a commando in the Second World War. So he said dealing with Milton was nothing like, storming the beaches. So between him, Ian Ross, Colin Plowman, who was the go-between with Milton but not with me, and Sandy Yugson, who was the director of RSSS and a very dignified and very impressive but honest and upright person, who'd been a major historian of Scotland and architectural of Edinburgh. There was and particularly then Dick Johnson, who was chair of the board of the faculties of general studies. There was a sort of review of Milton, which was very delicate. I can remember Sir Richard Blackburn saying it was like walking on eggshells, but of course nothing like what happened subsequently with redundancies and reform in future decades. And as a result, Milton was given a research position in 1977, and I was made acting librarian in mid-1977. To cut a long story short, Milton retired on very, very favourable conditions in early 1980, and I became the librarian. Okay.
Milton was the Chifley Library in existence then?
Oh, yes, yes. And that was one of the major things that will come to the reorganisation of the university library system. But Milton did very well financially in terms of what the payout, which was to go till 65, I think. And he established a major gardening centre at Buggendore, where he'd been building his house anyway.
Okay.
And then subsequently ended up, after that was sold after about 15 years, I think, as the Rose Garden curator at Old Parliament House, and never evinced any interest in libraries or books again, and one wonders who would have the best life, I don't know, in that context.
But let's go to the area of your now being librarian,
yeah,
and the tasks that were confronting you at that, yeah, stage.
Everybody says, oh, you lived in the golden age of the libraries, or the golden age. And I said, well, we did come in, there was always a budget cut. Every year we had the library from 76 after the Hayden budget of 75. So even though there might have been massive extra cuts, which we certainly faced in the 1990s because of devaluation and the Howard cut, it may seem like a golden age, but there were often perceptions of what the library should be and not be. The original major libraries had been the branch libraries. So you'd had the John Curtin School, you'd had the chemistry library, the geology library, etc. So the branch libraries had actually had the power through the research schools rather than the generic. And you had Menzies, which was 63, and Chifley, 67. And of course, Menzies had been lobbied by the Institute not to have one general library, a major mistake. But the Institute said we couldn't possibly, be in contact with students.
I remember all of this.
And I still remember, and people look at me now, I still remember there was a sign on the John Curtin Medical School library which said undergraduates are forbidden to enter this library.
Yes, yes.
And now there isn't a medical sciences library. Yes. So, this is how things change. And I remember Professor Barry Smith, who we got on very well with, saying that he didn't want students in Menzies, and then one of the problems is, subsequently, when we did the reorganisation, I'll come to that, he would have to go to Chifley and would have to be in contact with undergraduates. So quite an incredible change of mind. So after this, they couldn't really think about these big issues while Sims' issue was bubbling. So after I was appointed in late 1980, Ian Ross, whom I would regard, if you talk about mentors, was really, really superb. He and Peter Carmel, I think, were the best combination we've ever had in terms of the operation. In terms of the figure, because Peter had this role to play and Ian did the sort of day-to-day sweeping up, which is, you know, perhaps a role we perhaps would have in a provost type now, but we don't. So Ian said, well, we really need a review of the library. So in 1982, he chaired a very high-powered library committee, which had Professor Lacouture on and a number of Dennis Carr, etc., etc. And basically, I still remember Ian's comments at the introduction that reviewing a library was like reviewing a hotel, that, you know, it was extremely difficult in the different facets that it had. But one of the recommendations from that was, in fact, that they should be regarded as one library system, and that, in particular, the collections between Menzies and Chifley should be rationalised. So you may recall, but it was certainly the case, if somebody ordered a book on Russian history from the Coombs building, it went in Menzies. If you ordered a book in Russian history from the faculties or the general studies, it went into Chifley. So indeed, half of Manning Clark's books were in one library and half of Manning Clark's were in another. This went right through anthropology, whatever you wanted to do. And you still had messes between the embryonic Hancock building, which was the life sciences library, and John Curtin, and particularly geology and earth sciences. The 30 Years' War or the Civil War had nothing on some of the rivalries in academia, of course. So it took until 2 years of debate through the boards for the general concept, because there were a number of many major recommendations, that the collections would be amalgamated. And I still remember Hector Kinloch, who was representing the School of General Studies at the board of the Institute, saying, never have so many academics known so much about the Library of Congress classification, because it was literally at the boards. Somebody would say, I want HD 405 to 7 to stay in Chifley, and I want this to whatever. And then there was an incredibly massive move of the books, which took forever. Ian Ross kicked it off with a photo of him and the reporter moving books with students. So we eventually got the collections in some order, which ended up with Menzies being predominantly Asian studies and government documents, and Chifley being social science humanities. The sciences were still all over the shop to some extent, and as the cuts came through, and we're still talking about the print environment, the debates on where a print journal would actually be housed were quite fierce. And I was very proud in one way of A, having an extremely good library committee, and then a series of subject advisory committees, ChemLag, Sciences, BioLag, etc., which have now all since disappeared, which I think are still needed more than ever, but that's another story for later on. It was like, as I've said in a... I've contributed to a chapter in Dennis Carr's Festschrift, almost like medieval jousting between Peter Bishop in the John Curtin School and Dennis Carr in
RSPS. Yeah, I remember those times very vividly.
And we're grateful that people like Frank Gibson, who were quite sensible, were chairing the library committee at the time, because it did get very, and you would recall, Fife, that in fact the fights between Ken Campbell and Ted Ringwood and people like that, between geology and earth science, and Kurt Lambeck. And so our role was spending quite a lot of time sort of just keeping that competition.
Pacifying.
Yeah. In the initial years, the university did duplication funds of $20,000. But as things got tighter, that duplication cut. And we even had the bizarre occasion in, I think, about 1987, where the library committee decided it would walk between John Curtin and Chifley to decide how long it would take. Those who wanted to prove the case walked fast, and those who wanted to prove the case walked slowly. Now, this sounds like Monty Python, but it actually occurred. So much of those years were spent, A, doing automation, because there had been an automation mess under Sims. In fact, the Life Sciences Library didn't have a catalogue for about 3 years. And I still remember the science librarian, Cynthia James, who was a very good science librarian, but not the greatest... empathetic HR person at times.
Was there a period or a specific occasion or time which was transitory in terms of reaching a conclusion as to where how you should proceed.
In what sense, automation or collections?
Well, the whole issue, because there's a lot of conflict between...
Yeah, it was basically the 80s that sorted all that out.
Yes.
and as gradually, as we got to the digitization of text, and we did it, I'll come back to that perhaps later, but we were one of the pioneers in automation, which was good and bad, but it also did mean that we were able to finally get the automation sorted out, which was by the end of the 80s, so that we were the first university library in Australia on the internet. And we also received, I was one of the three people who got the government to fund a major, after the National Scholarly Communications Forum in 1993, that I edited with the proceedings subsequently with John Mulvaney. We got a major grant for access to electronic data serials. And that was subsidised by the government for 3 years. Now, that was still a horse and buggy by Elsevier and others, but it did open up that thing that you didn't actually need, and which is clearly the case now, is that you don't need to go and see print journals. They're on your desktop. So that question of the duplication actually then just eroded electronically, which was perhaps just as well, because after the cuts of 1996... and the devaluations of the 1980s and 1990s, we just couldn't have afforded that duplication anyway.
So we're talking then about the mid-80s,
yeah,
in terms of this transition.
Yeah, the moves were, I think, around 1996, I think, or somewhere in the 1986, I think, in terms of... I've got a reporter here where Professor Ross is actually... carrying books across the the campus. Now, what date is that? 1985, February 85. So that came out of the 1982 review. Collection rationalisation, extensive serial move, book and serials between Menzies, Chifley and Crawford. The librarian, Mr. Colin Steele, said the basic idea to promote one library concept with various buildings housing different areas of specialisation. With the Crawford, and that was another major issue, was then called the Crawford Library Building, would focus on the sciences. Subsequently, of course, Lady Crawford wanted the Crawford Building to move to the what is now the Beryl Rawson Building, and is now up near the, you know, up the other end of campus near the National Museum, so that the university then had to find a new name for the building. Now, of course, they would look for money, as I'm being told, for the new Union Court. Two new buildings, the cultural centre and the student, they would need a philanthropist or somebody who would give money for the naming. But at that stage, it was just who was left standing, and that was Sir Keith Hancock. So it became the Hancock Library. Now, I still remember Sir Keith looking rather bemused in the Hancock Library, saying, I can't understand a word of any of these books.
We just made it stop there a sec.
Gradually, what happened was that the collections got rationalised, but the next big... And we continued collecting quite significantly. So we had the 1 millionth book, the 2 millionth book, and those were quite big occasions because we were obviously progressing. We were outstanding in two areas, obviously the science collections in particular, and in the Asian studies collections. We had benefited very greatly from the work of Enid Bishop as Asian studies librarian and a man called Y.S. Chan, who was the head of the Chinese section and who was actually quite significant in developing our relationships with China libraries and having Chinese trainees for a year, including the first batch, included the daughter of the head of China's Secret Intelligence Service, who was number three in the their equivalent Politburo. And Jeremy Barmé in the Contemporary China Centre, as is now, benefited measurably from YS's entrepreneurial skills in getting secret provincial gazetteers out of China. And we had a number of trips to China, and culminating in the opening of the National Library of China in 1988, of the new building. So Asian studies were very strong. When we came to another review, because everybody was being reviewed, in 1996... The vast majority of the university, apart from the, you know, lingering doubts about science serials and the cost of them, was quite happy with the university library. We had a major review which included Peter Lyman from the University of California, Berkeley, and John Shipp, librarian of Sydney, and Helen Hayes, a librarian of Melbourne, and academics. And they were very generally very happy. The vast majority of the 36 or so submissions, however, were critical of the fact we weren't giving Asian studies the research collections that they wanted. So they very vociferously, because they were the last ones left almost having subject librarians in their disciplines, lobbied the academic staff quite significantly for Asian studies. So we had to say, well, Asian studies had to suffer like everyone else in the cuts, because we had major cuts in 1996 from the continuing devaluation of the dollar and John Howard's 20% cut on the university. So that was a bit tortuous in some ways, and resulted that we in fact had to review all staff members in the university library, which was a quite horrendous HR procedure, both for them and for us. And as a result, we were able to meet the budget cost, but we did have to get a significant number of redundancies that year and then subsequent year, which wasn't easy. And what we did then was, as a result of the Asian studies, we said, well, basically, you guys, you've got this amount of money. You decide whether you're going to buy Chinese, Vietnamese, Thai, whatever, and how you're going to process them, because they were buying huge amounts of material, but things hadn't been catalogued for 20 years. So what was the point? And these were very difficult things to be actually accommodated. So that was the structure that went on subsequently. And we then had to, between Robin Erskine, who was director of computing, and I, had to run down what we call SNIP, the Centre for National Information Publishing, which we'd established in Chifley, which was the embryonic ANUE press, and which was ahead of its time. But that was the easiest thing to cut, because people were seconded into it, and the head of some of his staff went off to the National Library. But in fact, we really were forced to make very quick decisions, as indeed a lot of the university were, just to get to meet the budget cuts. So it was getting more and more difficult. But we were able to sort of come out of that, and then the dollar started picking up in the early 21st century. And we established two things which were very significant. One was the ANUE press with the Malcolm Gillies, myself, Ian Chubb, and Robin Stanton, and Jim Fox in particular, established. And I still remember having to go around. I went round all the deans to persuade them, because Ian Chubb had asked Robin Stanton to do this, and Robin Stanton will play a key part in the next 5 minutes. But he had never gone round. He was then the Pro Vice Chancellor IT, and he had never gone round the actual deans, and so I had to cover them in 2 weeks and go to the boards and argue the case with Jim Fox and Malcolm Gillies. And Chubb, who had just come in, was very good in terms of supporting the e-press, which has been a major success and one of the major open access presses in the world. We also then founded the ANU repository for placing material in the repository, and that was the first in the country. And QUT, which is now the 18th in the world, was the second under Professor Tom Cochrane. However, we had been looking at major issues, because when Dean Terrell was the Vice Chancellor, he'd seen that libraries and IT were actually one, were becoming one. Which now isn't IT is the infrastructure which you build on whatever you're doing, but he'd seen that libraries would be supported or suborned into IT. So he placed Robin Stanton in charge of the library, and Robin's idea was that we should give more funds from the library to computing. And in one famous budget, he took $1 million off the library to put into computing. And at this stage, the library committee, which was very powerful, with some very powerful people on it, really got stuck into Robin, and issues went to the to the boards. And again, this was really starting to get to a problem. Now, Chubb had just come in, and everybody thought that of all the executive, Robin would be the first to go. But in fact, he stayed for the entire time. And he was the only one of the executive that stayed for the entire time. And we did ask Chubb a number of times why this was the case. And he basically said, I don't know anything about IT, Robin does. No, you've got to massage that a bit. But basically, I don't want to hear any trouble. So I will only take action if people have trouble. So Robin's answer to this was to dissolve the library committee and all the subject advisory committees, which never really restored themselves. And even now, the subject advisory committees are mere shells of what they used to be. And the library committee meets about once a year and it doesn't have the data.
So we're looking at about...
This is about 2002 now.
I was going to say 2002.
Yeah, so at this stage, I was reaching... I'd been librarian since 1980 and I was reaching the age of 60. And I suddenly thought Robin and I were on collision courses. And we had one of the problems with Robin, who was a very bright guy, but basically could never make a decision. So it would take him forever to make a decision and would continually rewrite things. And one classic microcosm of this was the Noel Butlin Archive. The Noel Butlin Archive had been over the tunnel and was used to belong, because it was set up by Keith Hancock, to belong to RSSS. But when I went away on holiday one year, the canny ear, Professor McAllister, Ian McAllister, who was director of RSSS, managed to persuade Chubb that in fact it was now more of an archival and therefore library responsibility. So it actually got put back into the library's aegis without any additional budget or anything like that. So Sue Coss, who was the sort of associate librarian and very experienced, she'd been executive director of the Australian Library and Information Association, was in charge of that. And her solution was, because of the budget cuts, is that you would have a archival centre in the Menzies Library, and that the Butlin Archive would be closed down as a physical access so that people wouldn't wander in. It was never heavily used, but had some wonderful historical archive material. And this took a year and a half. We had attacks from the Australian archivists. We had attacks. Robin wouldn't make a decision. It went round and round and round. We had Senator Kim Carr and Faulkner coming and complaining and having a protest meeting on campus. Robin wrote 35 drafts, none of which were ever released. And Sue was then attacked by people in RSSS that for denigrating the Butlin Archive. You can imagine the scenarios. And she had to take out private legal against, you know, some of these people because they defamed her and etc. And so this went on. And would you believe 2 years later, what did the archivists accept? To have an archival centre in Menzies and to close down the, you know, and the stuff would be brought into the thing. So the original suggestion that had taken 3.5 years to come to with enormous angst, and this was a microcosm of what I was facing with Robin. He might have felt he was facing it with me. So basically coming up to 60, and then I had to, you know, on a personal note, I'd probably become, because we were leading globally, in what the library was doing, but it became quite apparent that Robin didn't want us, and to a less extent Dean, and then Chubb wasn't really aware of what was going on, didn't want us to be globally leading. He wanted to be globally leading in IT, and the number of issues there, but he didn't want us, in the sense of his, what he had an ARC centre that Ian Ross had got, for example, who used to have McRobbie and Richard Brent in it, who were really the leaders of that, McDrobby now being the president of Indiana, of course. But basically, he wasn't interested in the library being global, that the library basically had to know its place. And so reaching the age of 60, and then talking to John Richards and number, I thought, they said, oh, well, we'll have another review. And I thought, having been through two reviews, both of which had been laudatory, apart from the Asian Studies thing, which we'd sorted out in the end by giving them that responsibility. And unfortunately, not even now, because of the budget cuts, anywhere like the research component that they once were, or the depth they once were. We're not terribly good at all in that from what we were. I thought not to have another review. This was 2002. I was reaching 60, had been in position since I was basically running the library since 77. So I thought, well, and then they sort of offered this, not the Milton Sims deal, which I would have loved not to be a rose garden, but Milton Sims deal, said, well, we'll give you a year and a half to do some research and future planning, which is a euphemism. But I thought, well, that's fine, and went over to Hancock for a while. In the meantime, I'd been doing huge amounts of stuff for the university, like we've been running Meet the Author since the late 1980s, which has major success and is still going, running the National Word Festival, the Magellan Society, which was set up in 1980. So there were lots of activities going on, and I was also chair with Malcolm Gillies and Ian McCallman of the National Scholarly Communications Forum, which is still going with the four academies. So there was quite a lot to keep me going. So to cut a long story short, I ended up in Hancock, and then when the space ran out there, I ended up in Copeland with facilities and services.
Had you left the university then?
No, I never left the university physically. I'd left being paid. Yeah. But so I left being
paid. But you had resigned.
Yeah, I just said, they said, you know, we're going to have another review because of this, and I knew if anyone was going to be backed, it wouldn't be me, it'd be Robert.
So in 2002 you resigned.
Yeah, yes, so I resigned in 2002, yeah. Late 2002.
And then you carried on.
On in Hancock till 2004.
Yes, yes.
And then stayed there for about 4 years, and then ended up in Copeland with facilities and services with Murray Napier. Which was the old Dean of Economics area.
Yeah.
And then, in a decision which I still think is wrong, the entire teaching and learning support services, which supported Copeland, Manning Clark Theatre, all the techos and the teaching and learning bookings people, were suddenly taken out and put right over in the Tony Lowe building in Innovations, miles away from where they were servicing, split the department in two, so the techos went off to now in Hancock, went to chemistry, then went off, you know, to they went off to where they're miles away from where they are supposed to be, and I was like this cuckoo which didn't belong really there. But fortunately, because of the work I was doing on National Scholarly Communications, Meet the Author, etc., Tony Mackay, who was then Dean of CAS, basically said, look, we've got some spare offices in CAS, come over, because I was doing quite a lot in her area, particularly social science humanities, and been there ever since. And hopefully have proved my worth in many ways, because we're still running the most successful podcast series for the university of Meet the Author. I'm still the secretary of the Oxford Society. I've been since 1976. The Magellan Society, which I ran from 1980 to 1996 on campus with the Spanish, Portuguese, Latin American embassy, morphed into ANCLUS, which is now the Australian National Centre for Latin American Studies, on campus, run by John Minns, and that's in Hayden Allen. So my extracurricular activities for the university had actually proven my worth. And the good thing is that while I do disagree with the fact that the library doesn't collect books anymore, my interaction with the library is not deep, and nor should it be. My interests have moved away in terms of support for the university and what I'm doing for the university. So I don't get any angst about what goes on. That's somebody else's problem and issues and challenge with.
Is there a librarian now?
Yes, the librarian is Roxanne Missingham, who came from the Parliamentary Library, and she has had to follow, she's had a difficult time, very difficult initially, she may not admit that, but very difficult, because Robin Stanton, after I went, gutted the library. So he gutted the library, and again, because there was no library committee, this didn't happen. Robin may disagree in the historical perspective, which is fine, but in de facto budgetary terms, he took out all the HR, all the finance, all the IT, all of our group that were supporting the repository and the press, and in fact, the repository virtually died for 9 years as a result. The press was able to be maintained because Jim Fox and Malcolm Gillies, before Jim Fox had Ian Chubb's support, kept it going And it had proven a success. So the repository died and we lost all of our initiative in that area. He then took all the staff out. And so by the time Roxanne came back in and tried to, and they realised libraries and IT were different, and that what IT does is provide, apart from the huge research projects and data, that the infrastructure for you, but it isn't an intellectual content that had been originally seen under Terrell and Stanton. So Roxanne couldn't get those staff back again because it's, you know, they've been taken away. So there were 30 odd staff taken out. And so she then had to rely on a central service or whatever. So she had major problems. The second problem was with the academics at the desktop, that they didn't need to move in physically into the library. Mm. We won't go into the fact that we might later on, that in fact what was originally happened, that we thought that the big science publishers would diminish in profits, like Elsevier, Wiley and Springer, hasn't happened, and in fact it's a global crisis now. But that's another issue. Mm. Is that basically libraries are being gutted to provide student learning spaces, and that's happening around the world. And what you have then is that you move the stuff, books out to repositories. So ours is out at Hume, and so we've got a huge amount of books out off campus which have to be brought back in if people want to use them. So more and more books are being moved out. And so teaching learning spaces are put in and computers, etc.
Yes.
So, but having said that, the Menzies is still a curious amalgam. It's got, in the lower part of Menzies, it's got huge runs of very little used Asian material and microfiche, which again could be better utilised as space, but that's just a by the by. What I disagree with at the moment is that basically the thrust to digitisation means that you don't basically, you still need books. You still need historical books, and a lot of them are not available easily. They haven't been digitized. And that whole digitization is based on the fact that you need a network to support it. As a lifelong reader of science fiction, when the network collapses or when civilization collapses, everything goes wrong. And I still remember 2 years ago when the whole network went down the university. People were standing outside buildings not knowing what to do. The library doesn't know how to check out a book anymore. People can't operate because, you know, the system, the E.M. Forster's thing, the machine stops. So we have a number of very great historical collections that could come free of charge to the library. Ralph Elliott's library had a massive collection of Alan Garner, which I managed to get to the Bodleian in Oxford because nobody wanted it. So the Bodleian in Oxford takes it, but not the ANU. Derek Freeman's library, Professor Freeman, who worked on Samoa, his library, when he died and then his wife died.
These are all the ANU.
Yeah, yeah. So the Ralph Elliott's library had some wonderful stuff on Chaucer and other. Derek Freeman's major collection on Samoa, his work with Margaret Mead and Samoa. Originally, the manuscripts were due to go to the University of California, San Diego. Nobody could find them after he'd gone. He had collections of his anthropology collections, and he had collections of Auden for poetry. That just went to a book dealer and ended up some of it at the tip. So we have collections that really, ANU with its history, that's the only thing I would disagree with, should find a repository. It doesn't have to be in Chifley, Menzies or wherever, but we should be able to keep some of this rare material in our rare books collection or wherever, because they would be given free. They don't, you know, immediately they have a housing and a processing cost. But that's probably our biggest angst at the moment. And I know a lot of the academic staff in the social sciences and humanities agree, but of course they have no power anymore, because the power of an individual academic has been deconstructed, even if they had it, although they certainly did in the early days from the School of General Studies and the bias, because they have no power, and they're increasingly in silos, and they're increasingly having to produce research articles to justify their existence, apart from the teaching. So the loads on them have increased. So the times of the disinterested academic who could spend time thinking about what's the big issues for the library or anybody else have tended to disappear. So that would be my concern. And Melbourne University, Sydney University and Queensland are still doing that to some extent. And we have let the whole rare books and manuscripts side disintegrate. Although, having said that, I think the Noel Butlin archive, which is on the original model we originally suggested, is proving to be a success, because they've had a good dynamic leader in Maggie Shapley. So,
Colin, you've been giving a pretty good idea of how you see the university at the moment.
Yeah.
And what do you think might happen in the near future?
Well, it's interesting because another role I have is, as you know, is getting some of the big names for emeritus faculty, apart from running Meet the Author, which we do. But I've arranged two coming up. One is Professor Maggie Snowling, who's the president of St. John's, but a fellow of the British Academy, a fellow of the Medical Academy in Britain as well. And she's going to give a talk in the John Curtin School in August on dyslexia. She's one of the great experts on dyslexia. And then we're going to get the Vice-Chancellor of Melbourne University, Glyn Davis, to give a talk on new models for Australian universities, and that's going to be on October 31. It's booked in at the moment. This book's coming out from MUP. That was a long way around saying that, obviously, reading back through some of the emeritus faculty interviews, everybody looks back at a golden age and everybody says, oh, it's never as good as when we were there, and etc. And, of course, everything changes, and the regulations and the bureaucracy has changed since the early days of when I came, Dunbar, Crawford, you know, Tony Lowe, then on to Carmel Ross. So even from those days, everything has become much more complex than the red tape and the HR. But I don't think you can disagree that there has been a corporatisation of universities that have gone on, and the managerial structure is more and more resembling a big business. And we are a big business. I think it's over $1 billion. And you've seen huge growths of the marketing sections of colleges, the alumni operations, which is still nothing like the Americans, of course. But So what you're seeing, from my perspective, and I think one of the issues that I have been able to do for the university in one way, and I can see the new Vice-Chancellor's talking about collegiality, is that in the Meet the Authors that I do, I'm dealing with the Law College, we're doing a big one on climate change, so we're dealing with Fenner, we're doing a big one on China in April, so that's Coral Bell, we're dealing with this, I do the dinners at coming up with Quentin Bryce and Virginia Hausiger on gender at University House. So I'm locking across, the library almost locked across the university. And I remember Chubb saying at a famous time to a group of the librarians, university librarians, he said, librarians are mice who can only aspire to be rats. Rats can only exist in the chancery. And basically librarians had that overview, but had no power necessarily to implement, nor should they, perhaps, in some of the academic areas. But you were able to see those issues. So what's happening now is that in dealing with all those, you see often colleges competing against each other, and then you see the silos. And how do you get that collegiality that the Vice-Chancellor is looking for? I think it's extremely difficult. University House doesn't exist in that mechanism anymore. Somebody was saying the other night, you remember you could go into University House and you'd sit next to a biochemist or a forester or an anthropologist. But now it's, you know, the Wednesday night dinner is dominated by the Chinese students, and it's a different environment, and the visiting fellows don't go in. So where do you meet the interesting visiting fellows that are on campus? And wearing my Oxford hat, I find out about people coming, and they may go as recently to Melanie Nolan and Dictionary National Biography, but nobody else knew they were coming. And where I am in Cass, I keep saying, you know, they had a world famous historian in the College of Language Literature last year, but the Cass Central didn't know he was coming because that element of the college had brought that person in, and the HRC didn't even know. So how do you get that collegiality when in fact they're in the silos, and even in a department they're often competing against each other because they're often being judged on the metrics of research evaluation. And in wearing my National Scholarly Communication hat, I think one of the worst things that's happened, which is playing exactly into the billion-dollar profits of the big publishers, is that publisher metrics or metrics and citations are in fact driving a lot of the activity of the academic community. And from the statistics and the global studies, the vast majority of articles are not read or cited. And in fact, if they are read, it's the abstracts rather than the majority. So you're getting this, and when we've taken this up with the Australian Research Council, they say, oh, we don't drive that, it's the universities. But the university said, well, yes, you do. We follow what you do. We follow the money trail and we follow the research. And of course, it gets even worse because the research publishing metrics, amongst other things, are going into the university league tables. And the university league tables are then driving student recruitment. So it's a vicious circle. So you get all these people fighting each other to do, in some disciplines, I won't mention science, I can just talk some about, rather obscure articles in rather obscure journals, which are hardly read, in order to drive this research evaluation.
Yes.
So basically, that's why I'm very pleased that what might be construed as impact would be, and therefore that links back to open access, you know, is getting greater play from the government. But I was talking to somebody in the industry department last week, because we're having a National Scholarly Communications Forum this year, and he said the government wants to play down the fact of publications not being as important. But how do they drive that? How do they drive? You need somebody who is a minister who leads it, and with all the other crises, they just don't. And this relates, we heard from Cambridge University, that the vast majority of patents doesn't drive as much innovation in Cambridge University as the open access material. But so again, those are the issues looking at the university, that the poor younger academic has got the teaching load, the increased bureaucracy, and then the desire by the college dean to actually implement, you know, whatever the research evaluation of the
yes.
time is.
Yes.
So I feel great sympathy. And then how do they then get the old-fashioned collegiality or interdisciplinary?
Yes.
And then the students, when I was in Oxford, you know, the students would have that very limited number of 24-week term. Yeah. And then could do other things. I mean, that famous one where they used to go off climbing in the Alps,
yes.
which doesn't actually happen now. Oh, it does, but not in the same sense. Our students are all working two jobs to keep, you know, to,
yes.
to look after themselves. So
yes.
that college life, which again, you get some of which in the halls,
yes.
isn't coming through quite as well because they're dashing in and off campus if they can actually find a car park.
Mm.
You know, so I think I'm extremely grateful to my time at the ANU. We originally only intended to come for 3 years and, you know, have ended up here since and wouldn't go back to England.
Yes.
But, in fact, I was offered to apply for the Bodley and an LSE in Nine Towns, but we decided to stay. I didn't know that Robin Stanton was coming, but that's another issue. But if you could go back and change time, you'd obviously do that. But
Colin, we're close to winding up. And the last thing I want you to... Not the last thing... But in closing up, there would have been a number of people that you would have interacted with who were, you would have called mentors. You've already
yeah.
mentioned one or two.
Yeah. Well, the ones in my early days, because I don't think you get too mentored as you get older, because you were then mentoring other people.
Yes.
But when I came, it was clearly Sandy Youngson, the director of RSSS, who I think was a major problem that he left as director because his daughter was ill in England. He left in 1980, but again, and Wang Gangwu was his counterpart, Professor Wang Gangwu, in RS PAS. And Wang Gangwu again was that sort of person. He and his wife used to, you probably remember, used to give parties on Sundays.
Yes.
And so he would invite students, the librarians, so that social milieu. And I can't. And that used to, I mean that. Peter Carmel used to give regular dinners. I mean,
yes.
you've got the same
yes.
Meal every time from Lena. But, you know, you'd have dinners and you'd go to that. Laurie Nicol had a few barbecues. I think it stopped under Dean to some extent. There were still the official dinners. And then, of course, Chubb didn't do them and Ian Young didn't do them to that extent, except a few official dinners. And, you know, Brian's got an incredible workload in the sense of him being an outside influence and then having to do inside. So that, and I don't know that many deans now have that sort of open Sundays where you come all day and meet, and because of the pressures on them. So Wang Gungwu, of course, went on to University of Hong Kong and now in Singapore, and one of the greatest Asia-Pacific people. Carmel and Ross, Ian Ross, were fabulous support in terms of that, and Dennis Carr and Ralph Elliott in the library context. So we had very good relationships with lots of academics, and subsequently, I think the big one, I think, was Professor Malcolm Gillies, because we worked together on National Scholarly Communications. He was very interested in information issues. And Ian McCalman from the Humanities Research Centre, and earlier Ian Donaldson, who's now back in Melbourne. So I think those are the people over the years. After that, you know, I was becoming more and more senior, and hopefully mentoring some people. But it was really those people in the university that provided a framework that wasn't, Ian was still very, sort of quizzical on budgets and things like that, but at least they had an appreciation of what you were trying to do and what the library was trying to achieve. It's interesting now to reflect, coming back to Ian Chubb's mice and rats thing, that when the librarian of La Trobe was appointed, he was the number two after the vice-chancellor. When Vic Elliott was here as librarian, I chided him. He was here from 2003 to 2012, when Roxanne was appointed. Oh, I may be wrong on that latter day. He was not even invited to the university retreat of the top 100 people down in the Southern Highlands. So again, Roxanne's trying to retrieve some of that, and is now, as a result of all the, because I was on heads of research schools, you know, what would be the Board of Education. Roxanne is now back because they realised their mistake, although having said that, she lost the staff and some of the impact. She's now back on the Board of Education, the Board of Research, or the Research Committee. She's on the Academic Board, etc. So she is locked into a lot more, gone back again to what the library can provide in a digital environment. So the library has gone up and down in the last 20 years to some extent in where it's regarded in the university. I wouldn't say there was anybody, apart from now Jim Fox, who I work quite closely with on the press and the emeritus faculty, that there's anybody really, other than the people I'm working with in Castle a daily, saying hello to, that there's a big interaction. Although I do work quite closely with Peter Konofsky and University House.
Yes.
But it's just that sense again that universities have changed and we can't do much about that. It's a corporatization, managerialism. How do you get a collegiality in that context?
Yes.
And the pressures in the university? And where is that going to go in the 21st century?
Yes.
It's going to be fascinating. Yes. In terms of, and we're now getting the whole of the Manning Clark complex knocked down because, as we heard last week, this will, sort of kickstart what might be an educational change in teaching, as we heard from Chris Grange. So if you don't have large lecture theatres in
yes.
the future, although they will have to do something and are doing something in the interim because they're using the School of Music and hiring places on Barry Drive, if you do have a fully online environment, how then do you interact with the students, and what is the nature of teaching, and what is the nature of a university? So that emeritus faculty lecture, what is a university in the 21st century, is going to be crucial
yes.
in debate for
yes.
Glyn Davis.
Yes, yeah, I look forward to that.
Yeah.
Colin, I think we may, unless there's any
no,
other
that's,
thing,
that's
I
fine.
Think
I
we
think
may
I'm coming
end up there. And again, I thank you for your time.
Yep,
and,
yep.